and welcome back to Extra Features Interview. Some crazy guy decided to come back for a second interview. I have no clue why. He must like me. Crazy man. Ryan Barton Grimley. I don't even want to discuss your film. I want to tell you some praise.
Okay.
Before we get in, I watch your films, and I don't know if this is you're going to take this really positively or really negatively. I feel like I'm watching a Hollywood movie. Your production is top quality. Your shots are good. It's well edited. Like, it doesn't look like an indie ever to me.
Thanks, man.
So that's the first thing I want to say to you. I like your films.
I appreciate it.
I enjoy doing them. I like you as an actor. I don't understand why you don't work in the big age.
You know, man, me either.
Because I think you're good.
Thanks.
I think your timing is good. I think you get the characters. I think you work well with other actors.
I like to think so. I mean, one of my favorite things is actually standing there in the middle of a scene with the other actors.
But we're all comfortable in your characters. Like, a lot of indie film I watch, they don't look comfortable.
Yeah, people always say that to me. They're like, I got this criticism a lot when I was first starting out as an actor. It doesn't look like you're acting. I'm like, what the hell are you talking about? That, I mean, one of the first things I ever read, as a teenager who was kind of obsessed with Steve McQueen was him saying, when you look like you're acting, then you're doing a bad job. And so, you know, that was kind of my influences, you know, the guys like that who were in Westerns and more kind of film actors. I also fell in love with like the method and that whole scene, but, I do feel like you can see some of their work, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Are you a method actor then? Like, are you that character 24/7 on set and all the time?
No.
Oh, okay.
No. I did do some of that when I did Elijah's Ashes, just because, I was trying to keep the drunkenness going and that kind of stuff. And I did some of that on Repatriation. I would just try to kind of stay in the feeling of the character. But I, you know, I'm not one of these, megalomaniacs who tortures the rest of the cast and the crew with their art or whatever. No, my whole goal is that, like, I know we're making make-believe, and I know that that's what we're doing, and I've made peace with that, and it's more fun that I can kind of let that go and just be there and kind of play around, you know.
I think you do a great job. So do you go on auditions and things, or are you just like, I'm done with that, I'm going to make my own films now?
Yeah, that's where I've been. That's number two. I've been in number two category for, 10 years.
But you're good.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Okay. I mean, I think I'm gonna start flogging the work from these two films around. But, you know, for years I had reps here in L.A., and I went out for stuff. I had a tough time, man. I couldn't get arrested. And to be honest, I was doing the same caliber of work. It's the same stuff. And I just didn't get it. And I felt like, I wasn't sure anybody could really see what I was able to do if it was just one or two lines. You know, I did a little bit on Criminal Minds, and I had a lot of meat in the audition, and they were so great. And then I got on set, and, you know, three of the five scenes got cut. I ended up with one or two lines on camera, and it just kind of killed me, and I didn't, you know, the people who were repping me, they were sending me out for stuff, but they didn't really believe in me either. So I was already writing, so I was like, you know, screw this. I'm just going to go and make some stuff and try to stay alive and try to make, you know, five movies. And so I made Elijah's, I made Repatriation, and I've got Hawk and Rev and Baby Monitor in post.
That's awesome.
Where I'm at. And I figure, like, at the end of, you know, now I'm going to start going out trying to grab somebody, but somebody who gets what I do. Like, because at the end of the day, I've had a lot of people come up to me after Elijah's got released and then into Repatriation who were like, hey, man, you're great, dude, but you really got to pick one thing. And I'm like, you know, that's not how I roll. Like, I need somebody who kind of supports what I do, which is I'm a multi-hyphenate, man. I like writing, I like directing, and I love performing, and I like doing all three at the same time.
I don't understand why you have to pick one thing. Sorry, I just want to go back to that point. I mean, I like your writing. I find you don't have any dulls in your scenes. They move quickly. I love your dialogue.
I appreciate it.
I get, they're very good conversations. I mean, obviously, I can tell sometimes it's a little forced, but that's just because it's a movie.
Yeah.
And you got to have those beats in to get the plot moving. I get that.
Yeah.
Even in this film. And I have no issues with that. But I'm like, you're comfortable, though. The female wasn't so comfortable in the scenes, but we'll get there.
So full disclosure, this film, Repatriation, I produced, played the lead. I did quite a lot of the editing. I did not direct, and I did not write most of the script. There was a lot of improvisation on screen. Doug, the director, wrote the initial scripts that we went out to go shoot. There's a lot of that stuff that we kind of cleaned up and changed and redid and workshopped and all that stuff. But at the end of the day, he is the writer of that. But, you know, I worked with him as like a creative producer on the whole thing from the very first draft. And he had been my production designer on my very first film, The Truth. And I just thought he was such a strange Midwestern talented dude and super creative. And, you know, I like Alexander Payne's kind of Midwestern tortured movies. and I like that feel. And I feel like in Canada, in Alberta and stuff, they make similar stuff. And it's just kind of culturally very different and specific. And I was into that. And so I worked with him the whole time. I mean, we went back and forth on the edit. We did many pickup shoots. We went back to Iowa a bunch of times. So I don't feel like it's 100% my movie, but I definitely feel like I had a major hand in the film, you know, and definitely getting it out there, getting it premiered, pushing it out there, finishing it, like getting that final polish on the edit. And the look of it all, I mean, if you watch both my films, they're very similar in that kind of feel. And I don't know. That's just how I see them. They look right to me that way. You know what I mean?
Oh, I think they look great. I guess we can get in the film. I wrote down nice establishing shots.
Oh, yeah.
I really enjoyed that I understood where this character was coming from.
Yes.
What he was walking into. And I thought that set up the movie perfectly for me.
Yes.
And I understood why he was going where he was going. I understood why he went to the bar. And
yeah.
I do understand, I wrote down why he doesn't take the ride home. And I wrote that early on in the movie. I'm like, does he want to go home? And then as the movie evolves, I understand why he doesn't want to go home.
Right.
But I don't know that at that time. So
right.
We can start my favorite thing. Where did you find the bar? Because you have a lot of bars in this. Is it the same bar?
No. So Doug, the director, and my cohort in this whole deal, he was born in he was born in Dubuque, Iowa. He did not grow up there. His father's family is from Dubuque, Iowa. So this is an old brick town on the Mississippi. It's northeastern Iowa, right on the border of Illinois and Wisconsin. It's kind of like Portland, but it hasn't been gentrified and it hasn't had this huge hipster economic boom, but it looks very similar. It has this beautiful old brick downtown and Victorians and all this stuff. And you know, I had like a John Deere plant and stuff right there by the river. And there are four universities in this town of 200,000 people. And there are a lot of bars.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, this place was known for bars and drinking, and people would come in from the farms on the weekend and get crazy there from both the Illinois, the Wisconsin, and Iowa side. So we, you know, we just went to a lot of these places. One guy approached us who said, "Hey, man, I'm an actor and a real estate agent in Dubuque, Iowa. And my brother owns a bunch of bars." And so Doug audition this guy, and he was like, hey, he's pretty good. He's a really nice guy. His name's Jeff Heffel. If you ever need to buy real estate in Dubuque, Iowa,
call Jeff Heffel.
His brother Joe had two or three bars, and he had one in particular that he only opened on, Thursday through Saturday, basically.
Uh-huh.
So we used the bottom floor of that and the top floor of that. And then we found a couple other bars that let us shoot there from 2 a.m. to sunrise. So we get like 4 hours in here, 4 hours in there. And I got to say, it was just the greatest town to shoot in. I wasn't from the Midwest. I'd never really spent much time there. Doug didn't understand what the hell I was saying. I kept saying to him, these people are so goddamn nice, man. I mean, so there's the one scene in the middle of the movie, and we're walking around in that beautiful park at night as my character and Camille's, there's that gazebo and all that stuff. We're shooting this. It's 20 degrees outside, right? Freezing. We're literally freezing to death out there. It's pretty windy. Nothing in this town stays open after 10 a.m. except for this one A&W root beer gas station thing. We're shooting out there. They don't even have a film permit in this town. They have a parade permit. You know, they're like, you file for a parade permit. Let us know where you're going to shoot. Don't block any roads and don't kill anybody. We're shooting in the middle of this courtyard. The police would just come over and be like, hey, guys, you know, the A&W is going to close. It's pretty cold out here. You want us to go get you some coffee? They're so nice. I mean, it's unbelievable. After shooting in L.A. where people are just like, hey, screw you, man. Get out of here. We don't want to deal with your stupid movie. It was just so nice. And like all these bar owners were just like, yeah, sure, put us in the credits. You know, we'd buy $50 of near beer, which I drank pretty much the whole movie. I'm just drinking these beer sodas the whole time. It's unbelievable. But,
what's a beer soda? I'm going to have to ask. Is it pop and beer?
Yeah, it's like a non-alcoholic beer.
Oh,
it's just,
okay.
Just the worst.
Okay.
Disgusting. No, I drank cases of that stuff, you know, through that movie.
I do have a note, you do a lot of drinking, and that is in my notes.
Yeah, so, I mean, the initial pitch of the movie when Doug was like, hey, man, you want to do this thing with me? And I was like, I'm in. He was like, I really love this old movie, The Swimmer, with Burt Lancaster.
I love that film.
Yeah, he's like, I want to do a similar thing with a GI coming home, and the guy's going to do a pub crawl, and I was like, awesome. And then it kind of went from there, and then I didn't realize that I was just going to be basically drinking the whole time.
Oh, you don't?
And I got to say, totally sober the whole damn time. The one beer I drank for real, and that was only because they ran out of this fake beer, was the one I guzzled when I ran down the steps in that movie, and then I went to chase the girl's SUV outside. But that was the only real beer I drank on camera, which was awesome. It was such a challenge to play this drunken fool the whole time, you know.
Yeah, that's great. That's so I was laughing. Yeah, because answered like half my questions before I even got there.
Sorry.
The running scene. When you're running after the girl down the street.
Yeah.
How many shots is that? Because you look like you're running for a while. That can't be one take.
With the two of us running there?
Yes.
Yeah. So we probably ran a quarter mile to a half mile. And they basically would, they drive alongside us. In this SUV, again, it was 18 to 20 degrees outside. We were happy to run to stay warm. There were no heaters. This was a very, very small crew. We had a crew of 5 people.
Oh, wow.
And there's this great behind-the-scenes photo I haven't really put on social media, but it was what Camille, played by Jess Mercer, the actress, and I were looking at. So it's basically us, her and her little Pico, me and my army thin desert jacket. It's 18 degrees. And then you see what we're looking at. And there's this crew there in parkas. You can barely see their faces. It's just so funny, man.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah.
So that's why most of the movie is inside.
Yeah.
Because
exactly.
It's hard to tell because the character shows up, Chad shows up at night.
Yeah.
So it's really hard for me to tell you if it's cold or not because there's no snow. And I mean, he's always inside drinking. Any scenes in this movie, everything's at night.
No. It's all nighttime all the time. It's kind of crazy, you know?
So I did have a couple questions, if you could remember. What pinball machine were you playing?
Oh, geez. Initially, we were doing one that was a Terminator 2 one.
That's a great game.
Yeah, and then I feel like that's a mix of a couple different pinball machines because one of them had this terrible background, so when we shot the other position, we ended up doing it at a completely different location.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah, it was a weird deal. But I don't remember what that last one was. That one was a daylight. We basically shot that two or three times at the very end of a day, or night, I should say, at like 7 a.m. after shooting since 5 p.m.
Oh.
So we were just completely punch drunk at that point.
How was the bowling alley? I liked that scene a lot. I thought that really came together for you, the character.
Yeah, bowling alley was really interesting. So they're big on, bowling leagues there in the Midwest. So this was a practice bowling alley. So the only people who ever bowled at this were these members of these teams. And so they basically owned their own bowling alley, these 10 bowling league teams. And this was like their practice place.
So like a training facility for bowling?
Kind of, yeah. So it was upstairs on the main drag of the street. It was upstairs above all these storefronts, which was very, very strange, an upstairs bowling alley. But it was awesome. I felt like I really got into the melancholy of the character there.
I think you did.
And I loved how Midwestern it felt and all American. And then at the same time, you start to kind of see the darkness with Chad when he sees that girl from his past who knew his ex-girlfriend. And I don't know. I love that stuff.
Oh, I enjoyed it immensely. Like I said, it worked for me. I think you really portray it. I do have some other questions. Because you didn't write it, maybe this would be hard. Because do military people normally get free drinks?
I mean, real GIs get free drinks.
Yeah, I get that. I didn't want to touch on that. I was trying to leave that out, but okay.
People who it's their birthday, but that's about it.
Okay.
I mean, you know.
Because in Canada, I got to say, I've never seen a GI walking around here, ever.
It's an interesting thing. I mean, when we were shooting there, I felt so bad because, you know, I would put on that uniform where we were staying, and I would just drive to set in it because we're just shooting out on the streets and different bars or moving around a lot. I didn't have a place I could go and do wardrobe.
Right.
So I just put on all the wardrobe and, you know, a bunch of times, like in the first couple of days, I would stop on the way there because I was also the producer and get, you know, some craft service stuff at the grocery store or get some gas, pick up a lens, whatever on my way to set to help out. And, people really thought I was a real GI. And they kept thanking me for my service because it's the Midwest. There's a lot of military there.
Okay.
And it just killed me. I mean, the first couple days, I would just say, oh, no, I'm an actor in this movie. And then
right.
I'd have to get into this whole protracted conversation with them about that. After a couple days, I didn't correct them. I just said, thank you for saying that. And right. I would just kind of move on. Real, soldiers and what have you and veterans would notice that the patches I was wearing on the uniform were incorrect. And we did that purposefully as part of the character's wardrobe design, as kind of like a secret that people could latch onto and be like, oh, maybe there's something a little fishy about that guy's uniform. You know, we had mixed Army and Marine patches, which are very different here in the U.S. But, you know, there on the streets in Dubuque, we saw quite a lot of veterans.
Okay.
And we saw people, you know, active duty, both men and women in uniform, very similar. Yeah, it was a trip.
Okay. My other question is free hot dogs at baseball games. Does that happen?
Totally.
Okay, because, again, we don't do that here, so that was new to me.
Yeah, so that's like a thing like, you know, like the parents' booster club or something.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
See, these are things. We used to call them treats, and the parents have to bring something at the end. I don't think everybody's brought hot dogs. These are just like something packaged, some fruit, and a juice box here.
Right, right.
I guess being up in Canada, we can't do hot dogs for some reason, probably something I'm not allowed to do. Now, since you brought up the end of the film, can I bring it up then?
Yeah, what the hell? Why not?
Okay, I don't want to ruin it. So, Camille doesn't know what's going on?
I don't think she does.
Because she's new in town. That was very stated that she's left and come back.
Exactly. So, she, they're basically the backstory of all those other characters is that they're mostly all back in town for this wedding.
Correct.
Most of those women. And she's one of them. And and that's the same wedding that Felix, played by Jonathan Wickholm's character, his mom is involved in that wedding as well. And he's only going because his mom's going kind of thing.
Right.
But so that's how that's all kind of connected. Yeah, and I don't think she's seen Chad probably since she last saw him in high school.
And
she was a couple of years younger than him, so he went to college and kind of disappeared.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't really want to get – I'm going to discuss this off, so I'm not going to really ruin it. But you bring back my favorite character, which I'm allowed to bring up, right?
Yes, yes.
Ari shows up, made my day.
Oh, yeah.
I'm like, hilarious. Oh, there's this, there's my nugget I'm looking for.
Oh, yeah. He's funny, man. He initially was going to play the Felix character, but things didn't work out. And we went and did the first shoot. And then we did three or four rounds of pickups. And because the initial shoot was only 14 days.
Oh, wow.
So we added a couple days here, a couple days there. And we wanted to add this really funny scene from the beginning with this you know, this clerk at this Quickie Mart, and we just could never get the location right or the timing right, and then it just kind of serendipitously Doug, the director, was living in Oakland at the time, and there was this great grocery downstairs from his apartment. Ari was available, I was available, we hopped in a car here and drove right up there during the day, shot it, and drove back just like that.
Wow, because I didn't think that was a day. And that's when Ari asked you for military ID.
Yes, yes.
I thought that was funny. I'm like, what's military ID? I guess it's just ID to say you were in the military.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, when you're near a base, they have a lot of these issues. Like, you know, they accept military ID in lieu of an actual driver's license.
Okay.
For your age being 21 to drink and whatnot. So, yeah, that was the kind of thing where I was showing just my BS driver's license, like just kind of flashing this thing at them. And they were like, what the? He's like, that's not a military ID. That's your driver's license, yeah, man.
So I think I should have picked up on that, but I should have figured out the ending there.
Right.
And I'm like, I missed that. What was I doing? I think I was so focused on Ari, I wasn't clued in. But I did clue in then when he
He's
said,
hilarious.
Look at my shorts. I bought these at Army Surplus. I'm like, okay, I got it now. I started cluing in there.
Yeah.
And is that what I'm supposed to clue in, I presume?
Yeah, I mean, there's some different little spots here and there. that don't make sense. Like, there's that one scene in the bar when Chad goes back in to get his bag when he's going to go for his walk with Camille, and he runs into Leslie and her friend, and her friend says, you just got back. Where were you stationed? And he, you know, says, I don't remember what town he says. She's like, oh yeah, you might know him. And he's like, no, I don't think I do.
Yeah.
That I think was probably one of the first. We had some earlier scenes with more people at the veterans bar that we kind of cut just because they just were slightly off and they didn't make the cut. But there were a couple things in there. And part of the problem was they were kind of giving up the twist too early. But it's funny, this whole talk of that kind of brings up the approach that Doug and I had to playing that character. So what we decided upon together was kind of like, if you just play it like you actually are that guy, like you're that delusional, that you will trick yourself into believing that you are that. And then in a couple places, you just deny the fact that that's not the case when people bring it up. It's a very different approach than playing it with guilt or what have you. And it also kind of throws into light the fact that this character does that a lot, yeah. Which, interestingly, right when we started shooting, CNN had this big expose on four or five different guys they followed through the Midwest in very similar towns to Dubuque, the Midwest and the South, that were all doing the same thing.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and when we were shooting those scenes on the street later when Chad's pretty drunk and he leaves the bar after getting in a confrontation with the guy who's playing pool, which is a pretty intense scene. Well, when we were walking on the street there shooting live, it was graduation weekend in Dubuque. We had gone back a year later, and I mean, downtown was hopping. It's like 1 a.m. There's everybody everywhere, and I was walking down the street, and we were just shooting live. And this man just stormed out of this bar and kind of came right up to me while we were shooting and got in my face and was like, what the hell is this? What the F is this? What are these patches? I should rip this off your arm, man.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, whoa, whoa. And he was this like huge guy. He had a head kind of like a mohawk. And he had a blue goatee, was dyed blue. He was really drunk, very sweaty, big guy, cut off t-shirt kind of deal. Probably like I thought he was like a biker or something like that. Turns out this guy was a veteran.
Oh, okay.
Turns out he's been working downtown there in all these bars, and it's been a real problem. He's caught four or five guys just in the last year who've done similar stuff. So when he saw me walk by with the fake patches, he was like, holy shit, there's another one. I got to go get that guy. So I'm standing there and I'm like, hey, whoa, I'm an actor, man. And he was like kind of so intense and a little inebriated. So I'm like, I'm an actor. We're shooting a movie. Look, there's a camera right there. That's a microphone. That's a boom. You know, this is the makeup person. That's Doug, the director. And he kind of looked around and kind of got his bearings, and he took it in for a second, and he just went right back into it. And it went, yeah. And thankfully, Doug came over and kind of interjected, and I just walked away because I just really – it was too crazy. Like, it was like life imitating art imitating life, and we were just kind of in the current of the zeitgeist. And I think that's – also what helped us get this great deal with this distributor, Indie Rights, is they did their research and saw how current this theme is. Other people had pitched movies to them about this, and we had already made one. So they were like, yeah, we have to do this.
Well,
it's
awesome.
What got us our festival premiere at Film Invasion LA, which we ended up winning the grand jury prize for.
That's great.
Yeah, and it was all this weird little niche-y, horrible thing that these guys who are sad and have a hero complex, and all these things are doing to kind of play make-believe because they, you know, because that's what's admired in these towns in the Midwest is service and this kind of military heroism and this kind of stuff. And these guys, you don't have a lot going on, you know, just jump on that train. And it's an interesting psychosis, you know, it's very strange. It was interesting to play. I gotta say,
I really started piecing parts of it together with the parking lot attendant.
Mm-hmm.
That started cluing me in. Like I said, I knew something was not right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I was piecing things together, but I do have a question for the end of the film, and if you don't want to answer it, tell me.
Sure.
How many times has this happened before? Because his parents remark on that.
We didn't put a specific number on it, but we came up with the idea that it had happened so many times he'd gotten kicked out of the house and no longer lived there.
Well, that's what I got from that, because his father, right. I presume, says to his wife, going, just let him sleep in his bed tonight.
Yeah, and there it is, his kind of temple to the high school baseball hero.
Yeah.
All intact. Trophies there, nothing changed, and, you know, yet it's like the hero complex, you know, it never died. He was still trying to attain that kind of, that elusive feeling again of adoration and acceptance and praise and what have you. I mean, not unlike most artists, you know, live the same horrible nightmare as well. I mean, we're all trying to get acceptance for our art and get some kind of, you know, validation for our work as artists. And especially in film, it's such a competitive, rough field. Like I really kind of identified with Chad in a way that I didn't feel like it was that far from me.
Wow.
Like, I would never have done what he did, but I also didn't feel like it was that far from me. Like, I totally get where he's coming from, and feel a lot of empathy for it, you know?
So, I guess what I don't really want to get into this on this. This has become a private conversation for us. So, the film's gone to the Jamboree's, the Los Angeles Grand Prize. He won that. Did they want anything else for this film? Because I really
We won the grand prize at Film Invasion LA. We played, another 20 some festivals. We also did a bunch of jury contests. I won Best Actor at Actors Awards, which was really cool. I won, like, Best Performance of the whole deal, and then I was a runner-up for their yearly contest. We won Best Picture a bunch of times. We won Best Drama. We won Best Indie. We won Best Script. We got a lot of great, like, smaller, you know, small to mid-size kind of film festival accolades. We were never able to get into the larger festival circuit, but at the end of the day, I think that really kind of helped us because we did submit to them and then, you know, we didn't get in and we kind of went and did some pickups and reworked stuff and we kept going back to the well and making the film better. So, you know, we were in post for about 2.5-3 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So we did that for a while. And then, again, we didn't get into Sundance. And, you know, Sundance is happening right now. And Doug did work as a production designer on this film called Prairie Love that played Sundance. And this was like a $50,000 movie. And the guy who played Dean Watkins, Chad's friend in the bowling alley, Jeremy Clark, he was the lead of that movie. And it was like this kind of Cinderella story of this little tiny indie they shot in the snow and, you know, the late 2000s in North Dakota. And it went to Sundance. they premiered in the next section. They all got to go. You know, we had very similar hopes for our film. But at the end of the day, I think we had a much more elusive, complex story to tell. And that's why we had to keep going back. Once we were done, one of the very first festivals we approached was Film Invasion LA. Our producer's rep, Glenn Reynolds at Circus Road, he knew the programmer. So he was like, I can at least get them to see it. Cause I mean, one of the things with these smaller films like we make, you know, we don't have a studio name behind it. We don't even have a large indie name behind it. We don't have name actors. We don't have all of those things. If you look us up online, we have decently healthy, social media presence for sure. And we've got trailers and all this stuff, but at the end of the day, I mean, these programmers for these larger festivals, you know, they're kind of like, well, what are you going to bring with your film? It's great that you made a nice film, but like, who's going to come to see that film? Like, how does that all work? And, you know, they're trading slots with people for stuff.
Of course.
And so a lot of times you don't even get seen by, like an assistant, programmer or anything like that. You're just being seen by interns. And so it's very hard to even get seen by the people who really make the decisions. So this was a very cool thing that happened. And Jeff Howard, who's a programmer at Film Invasion LA, which is, it's like a 3-year-old festival here in LA. He only plays independent films.
That's
he does
funny.
Not play any studio films. He only plays 8 features. He has a short play before each feature. He does 4 films per weekend, and then he is done. It is a small, very high-end indie, truly indie film festival. So it was so cool to get asked to be in that because it was real. Like, we knew the other films we were playing with were other, you know, indie filmmakers like us who had skimped and scraped to try to make something, you know, unique and on a shoestring, and to win grand prize there, just, I mean, that really set it off for us. It really helped out.
Well, that's awesome.
It was huge.
I have good news for you since last we've talked.
Yes.
Amazon Prime is available in Canada now.
Oh, awesome.
December 16th, it went live.
That's fantastic.
But I can't find your film because I did look.
So Repatriation and Elijah's Ashes are both on Amazon Prime here.
But not on Canada. So you got to figure out how to do that. I don't know if they haven't rolled all those out here yet because some other indie filmmaker asked me and said, I'll check. Because my friend mine has Amazon Prime, so I asked him to check. He said, nope, they're not on here.
I am going to email our distributor today. Right,
so I'm trying to help you guys out saying you're not on Canada yet. So just so you guys know.
I appreciate that. So, you know, I got to say, like, Amazon Prime is become the place
for indie
to
films?
Find really good indie films.
I have to admit that most of my screeners and stuff, somebody will say, yeah, it's on Amazon Prime, and I'll send you a link anyway. And I'm like, thank you so much. But I mean,
yeah,
that's
the place for good indie.
But I think that's great. I think that's great. I think people are going to find you through this podcast, I hope. And
I really appreciate the opportunity, man.
Well, you know I love your films. And I said that about Eliza Ashes. I love this one. So I still want to see her first one eventually. So.
Yes. So, we should do a thing where you can watch the initial cut and then the new cut.
Sure. I could do that.
Because that'd be really different. You'd be like, whoa. There's the fresh-faced first-time filmmaker, and there's 10 years later, you know?
I made some questions up for you while you were talking.
Yes.
So I know
you,
everybody likes fun questions. I always get in trouble if I don't have new ones.
Oh, I'm into it.
Okay.
Let's do
first
it.
Movie ever seen.
First movie ever seen.
In
the first film I remember seeing ever. I was in a theater. I was probably 4 or 5 years old in Zimbabwe, where I was born and lived the first 10 years of my life.
So hold on, you're African then?
I am officially an African of European descent. I'm an American citizen now, but yeah, I spent the first 10 years of my life in Zimbabwe. I was born there. My mother grew up there. She was born in South Africa. My father was born in Kenya. They met there, had me. We moved here in the mid-'80s when Mugabe got into power and, you know, things got a little rough there.
I was about to say it was probably time to go.
Yep. But I remember seeing this movie at a theater there. I must have been 4 or 5. And it was kind of like a Cujo ripoff. It had a killer whale. I think it was called Orca.
It's Orca. That's a Dino Lorenzo film.
That was one
film.
Of the first movies I remember seeing, and I remember
you have to be
literally
older to
crying
that.
So hard I pissed my pants.
You must
I was
be the same
so
age as
afraid.
Me. Are you 46?
I am 43.
So you're younger. See, Orca came out about 76, 77?
Yeah, so I mean, you got to think in Zimbabwe, by the time something made it there from the U.S., it's five years later.
So I'm about right on the year. I'm like, that's got to be.
Yeah.
I'm guessing your age just on the film. I'm like, I'm trying to think when that came out. Yeah, he did it because Jaws made so much money.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's
exactly.
A terrible film. Why would your parents take you to see that?
I don't know. You know, they probably thought it. I was there with a bunch of other little kids. I remember we were all crying.
Oh my God.
But it's funny. I mean, you know, my next two movies that are in post right now both have elements of horror. And, you know, at the end of the day, like, I love watching horror and horror comedy, and maybe that has something to do with it.
That's great. <You know? laughs> Number two.
Yes.
Have you ever walked out of a movie?
Yes.
What movie?
Yes. I walked out of Jim Jarmusch's Coffee and Cigarettes.
Really? It's boring as hell.
It's so fucking excuse me, boring.
It's all good.
I was like, come on, man. Like, you know, at least try.
He doesn't. I don't think Jeremy Rivers even directs.
Yeah,
I think he just turns on the camera and goes, we're going to do this scene. You guys can do what you want. And just say a few lines of dialogue and ad-lib the rest. I do find a lot of his films like that. I do try to watch Jim Jarmusch films. I don't get them.
I do, too. I want to support, and I feel bad like that I don't. I actually, the older I get, I'm kind of maybe my taste is becoming a little more mainstream. But I still try to watch a lot of these, you know, indies for indie's sake and just to support, you know, but just to support some kind of different voice, really. But
I agree. What bugs me is when they say mainstream, like they say, well, they know that indie darling, Greta Gerwig. I'm like, Greta Gerwig has not been indie in like 10 years, guys.
That's absolutely true.
And it
I mean,
drives me
cry,
nuts
right?
when they go on about the indie film Lady Bird. I'm like,
Lady Bird had a $5 million budget.
Exactly my point.
About
that's
that.
Not, but that's what I read. I'm like, guys, I do an indie podcast. I know what indie film looks like. That was not indie film.
Saoirse Ronan is not an indie film actress.
It drives me nuts.
She's listen, she is seriously talented.
Oh, I agree.
And the movie is a good movie.
Right, but
it's not an indie.
But it drives me nuts. Like, Hunt for the Wilderness People was an indie film to me.
Yeah.
But now Tiki's blown up. He can't make that anymore. Now he has to make mainstream movies, and that's okay with me.
Yeah, totally. I love that guy's work. I try to emulate him as much as I can. Like, I love Boy. I love What We Do in the Shadows.
I have not seen Boy, but I have seen What to Do with the Shadows. It made me laugh so hard.
So good.
That guy is brilliant. The jokes
He's
work.
He's brilliant. Yeah, what a talent.
Okay.
Very jealous of that guy's work.
So am I, because I can't do it. Biggest pet peeve at the movie theater?
I can't stand people, you know, on their phone.
In the middle of the movie, and they pick it up.
Yeah, it kills me. I'm like, dude, your screen is so bright.
And my wife gets mad at me because I yell at them.
Yeah. Yeah, you're like, turn it off!
And they're right beside me. And my daughter's like, Daddy, you okay? And I almost picked up and whipped something at them the other day.
I mean, I said to this one guy one time, who was he? There was a seat between us. But, I mean, he was literally on his phone doing Facebook likes, and he had the chime set on. So it would be like, whoop, whoop.
Oh.
And I look over at him, and I go, seriously, dude? Come on. I mean, is your ADD that bad that you literally can't even just focus on this thing? I mean, this is a hilarious movie. It was Thor Ragnarok.
Oh, it's a great
movie. It's hilarious. Great
film.
And I'm like, come on. And Mike, if you do that anymore, I'm totally going to go and tell the management. And he cussed me out. So I went and told the management. I went and got an usher. I was like, that guy cussed me out. And he's using his phone. And I brought the usher in there. And, like, it kind of made a big stink and ruined it for about 5 minutes. But there were three or four other people who totally had my back. They're like, yeah, screw that guy. He's a jerk. We paid, like, in L.A., it's $20 to go see a movie.
So, is that a matinee or an evening performance?
This was like a 6 o'clock performance.
So that's evening. $20. So that's about 30, 25. That's expensive.
It's very expensive.
Is that, okay, I'm going to ask a stupid question. Is that like at the Arc like?
Yeah, this was at like the AMC, but it was their, their IMAX 3D thing.
Okay, so yeah, that would be the same price as mine. Mine's about 18.
Yeah.
To see it, because I saw Kong there, because I wanted Kong to be 100 feet.
Yeah, totally.
Because to me, you got to see action films big. I saw Dunkirk there, too.
Yeah, exactly. You want to see him full size, the latest Star Wars. I want to see that like an event. I want to see as big as possible in 3D if it's available with the best sound, the whole deal.
I agree.
Why not?
So tell everybody where they can find their film, even though I kind of ruined it, but I was trying not to.
No worries. So you can find Repatriation on Amazon, Amazon Prime specifically. You can also find it on Google Play. And I think we're going to come out with DVDs and Blu-rays.
You should. I've been hearing more.
Probably mid-February. You can find it at repatriationfilm.com. We're on Facebook. We're on Instagram, Twitter, all that business.
Great.
You can find me at rbgfilms.com and Ryan Barton Grimley. I got about 4 films worth of social media feeds out there.
That's awesome.
So, you'll find us. We got a really funny horror comedy we're shooting pickups for next month called Hawk and Rev, Vampire Slayers, and a great psychological horror movie called Baby Monitor. Both of those should be done and out to festivals by the summer. So,
okay, you might make Toronto. Then.
What's that?
You can make Toronto then.
I would, man. I mean, if we could actually play that festival, that'd be incredible. I really want to play Toronto After Dark.
Yes, we have that here, and they have I can't remember. I'll just send it to you. We have another one, an indie one.
Yeah.
Too, and I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head.
Yeah.
Hot Dogs. No, there's a Hot Dog one. There's another one. There's an indie one.
I
forget the name of it. Sorry, my bad. Just can't remember.
I appreciate it, buddy.
Well, thank you for your time as always.
Me.
And you know you're awesome, so keep up the good work.
Thank you, man.
Okay.
You too.
I keep trying. Somebody of us is.
You're so supportive, man. Without people like you, no one knows we even exist.
You're too kind. You're too kind. Yeah. I'm just a guy with a computer. That's all.
It's awesome.
Okay. Bye.
All right, buddy.